Hello and welcome to the Mystic Cast, where you join me, Jack Stafford, a student of metaphysics, as I talk to a variety of guests to better understand the teachings given by the masters through the Aetherius Society, the new cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age, incorporating all yogas, Christian mysticism, theosophy, UFOs, ancient civilizations, and much, much more. Please note, this is an independent program, not produced or fact-checked by the Aetherius Society. Today, my guest is Michael Kramer. Hello, Michael.
Hi.
How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you. So you're a big name in the field of ancient civilizations, and I'm really pleased to be able to speak to you because in my humble opinion, there's three things that the Silence Group want to keep quiet, and that's UFOs, our ancient history, our real history, and reincarnation. And so we're here today to talk about the middle one. And
I think they're all related.
they are all related. Yeah. I mean, if you're interested in ancient civilizations, it puts a different perspective. If you think, well, I was there, I probably built those pyramids. You know, if you're an Egyptologist and you're obsessed with Egypt, chances are perhaps you were there. You feel a great connection. So, and I know you've been on the Ancient Aliens series as well, so that it all ties in. Yeah,
definitely does.
So how do you feel about this? Because you've been doing this a long time now. Where are you in the emotional scale? Are you jaded and you think, well, I've done all the work now, believe it or not, take it what you will. I'm not trying to convince you anymore. All the evidence is there. Do what you will.
Well, I think I've always had that attitude that, yeah, all I can do is present what makes sense to me, what I think might be valuable for other people, and just leave it up to them what they're going to do with it. I think that's always been, you know, one kind of attitude. I'm not into trying to compel or force anyone to accept my ideas. I just put them out there, and if someone takes it up, fine. If they don't, that's their decision, their freedom.
So you passed any frustrations about people not listening?
I wouldn't say I'm frustrated. It just seems to be a fact of life that in the universe, there's always been two categories of persons, those that are moving towards darkness and those that are moving toward light. So it's out of my control, really.
Those that want to listen will listen.
Yeah.
Mm. And how do you feel about people who have come on after you, like people like Graham Hancock, who, you know, they cite your work, but you were one of the originals?
Graham Hancock, I think, is doing wonderful work. He actually wrote a foreword for one of my books, The Hidden History of the Human Race, some time ago. And occasionally we run into each other at conferences where we're both speaking. But, you know, he has his area of research, I have mine. And, you know, they overlap in some ways, but they're not exactly the same. But I think he's followed a path that many of us who get into these things go through, which is we might start out with archaeology, stones, bones, artifacts, monuments, but it leads gradually to other things because you get into the whole alternative cosmology field, which tends to involve a consciousness-based universe rather than a strictly matter-based universe, and that gets you into spiritual practices and mind altering, consciousness alter altering types of experiences. So I think a lot of us in these fields have kind of progressed in that way.
That's really interesting. So you start out trying to convince the materialists or arguing on their terms, using material evidence to try and convince them. But then as you get further into it, because I know you've come from a Vedic background, you're very into this, and because the consciousness and things like that is, if you try and prove that with prove non-material things with material things, you're arguing in just two different languages there.
Yeah. So ultimately, I regard what I do as part of my practice of yoga. I'm a practitioner of bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. And part of that practice is to use whatever talent or ability one might have for a higher spiritual purpose. And, you know, somehow or other, I got some ability to string words together on a page, to write, in other words. I could use that ability for many different things, but I've chosen to apply it in this field of alternative understandings of human origins and antiquity, with the idea of bringing people who may be interested in these topics and not already committed to them to an improved understanding of their real nature.
It's interesting you say back to yoga. I would have thought Nani yoga than the yoga of wisdom, because you're all about knowledge and studying. And
yes, that is with bhakti, with devotion, also comes knowledge. Like my guru, Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, his name actually reflects that. Bhakti Vedanta, devotion and Vedic knowledge together. Because without that background of knowledge, sometimes devotion can be just some sentimentality without any real foundation. So I think both things are important. The bhakti, the devotion, the love, and also knowledge and understanding.
Exactly. All the yogas are tied in together, and it's karma yoga as well. It's action, because you're going to conferences, you're writing books, you're working.
Yes, that's a fact. It includes karma as well.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, that's what that word is there in my spiritual name that I got at the time I was initiated. It's Druta Karma, which is a name for Vishnu or Krishna that means more or less fast work.
So where do we start then with this conversation? Is I suppose we go back to the materialistic aspect and the evidence from your book, Forbidden Archaeology. How would you like to start? What, after all your years, what is, you think, is the most important things that people can grasp?
Yeah, well, let me try to relate the work that I did in that book, Forbidden Archaeology, with the larger questions of Vedic cosmology and spirituality. Forbidden Archaeology contains archaeological evidence that shows human beings have existed on this planet for hundreds of millions of years, basically going all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. And that information is given in the Puranas, which are the historical writings of ancient India. And the significance of that is that ultimately the universe has a purpose. And I believe its purpose is to be like an educational facility for conscious selves who have come to this level of reality for whatever reason. It's an opportunity for them to perfect their consciousness, to become free of all kinds of behaviors and mentalities that lead to so many of the problems that we see in the world around us. So if that is the purpose, and that purpose is achieved in the human bodily vehicle, it makes sense that that human bodily vehicle that is capable of reaching those understandings would be available right from the beginning.
Right.
Just like we send a space station up into Earth orbit. We don't just hope that somehow or other the chemicals in the space station will combine together and form some first simple living thing and hope that it will evolve into astronauts. We send the space station up because we have astronauts that are going to be sitting in it and working and researching. So I think that's the ultimate significance of this evidence that human beings have existed on this planet for vast periods of time is. It means we need new explanations for human origins, and they're going to involve consciousness, which is an unsolved mystery for modern science.
What kind of evidence did you find? Was it footprints or artifacts? And how did you date it? Was it carbon dating or the level that it was found at?
Yeah, very good questions, Jack. Yes, the evidence takes the form of human skeletal remains, human footprints, and artifacts normally attributed to Homo sapiens, human beings like us, by archaeologists. And this evidence is not found in the current textbooks of archaeology. You really have to dig into the history of archaeology and look at all the reports originally given by archaeologists, geologists, other scientists looking into the earth, digging into it. And when I did that, I found hundreds of reports of scientists, including archaeologists, finding these things. And I give an example from the earlier history of archaeology. The 19th century, gold was discovered in California, and miners went there to get the gold. They were going to places like Table Mountain in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in central California. And they were digging tunnels into the sides of that mountain to get at the gold-bearing deposits. And deep inside the tunnels and the solid rock, they found human bones and human artifacts, stone mortars and pestles, obsidian spear points, and also human skeletal remains. And these came to the attention of the chief government geologist of California, a Harvard University educated geologist named Dr. J.D. Whitney, and he collected these artifacts. He did his own research and studies to confirm them. And he reported them to the scientific world in a book published by Harvard University. Now, what makes these discoveries so interesting to me is that they were found as layers of rock that modern geologists tell us are about 50 million years old. Now, the current scientific consensus is human beings like us appeared only about 300,000 years ago at most. And before that, they say, well, there were no human beings like us on this planet. So they were a really significant discovery, but we don't hear very much about them today because of the process of knowledge filtration that operates in the world of science. Dr. Whitney had a contemporary, Dr. William Holmes, who was an anthropologist working at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Holmes said, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of evolution by natural selection, he wouldn't have published those findings of his. In other words, he would have known can't possibly be true because it contradicts, you know,
the gospel
that's dominant. So those artifacts are still in a museum at the University of California at Berkeley. They're not displayed to the public, but they are there. I've seen them, photographed them. And, I've also gone into the Sierra Nevada Mountains and looked into some of these old gold mining tunnels. So it should be possible to do new research there and get further confirmation of these things. But if this happened just one or two times, you know, this knowledge filtering that results in a discovery not being so well known, if it happened just one or two times, then you might be able to say, okay, well, there are a few anomalies, you know, but yeah, you know, the vast majority of evidence confirms our present theories. But this knowledge filtering didn't happen just one or two or three times. It's happened hundreds of times. So what happens is we wind up with an incomplete set of facts to make our judgments about these things.
Mm-hmm. So that's just one example. I know there's many in the book. So can I just ask a question about, because in the Theory Society, we understand that the Teaching Theory Society that civilization, it peaks like Lemurius and then goes down and then Atlantis and up and down. And then the age we're in now, I mean, you know, if you think 150 years ago, we've gone from inventing the bicycle to space travel civilization could go really up. So is it right that, because you're talking about pestle and mortar and finding, we think about, you know, it's not possible that civilization stayed at, you know, 18, hundreds of millions of years and we're all cavemen for all that time. I mean, there must have been these peaks. So is it possible that only stone and bone are preserved for a long time? If there was plastic and paper and other complex items, that they would have been destroyed over these millions of years under all this pressure of the rock?
I think you're right about that. One thing is not only paper and plastic are easily destroyed or they disintegrate. Even say if you have a laptop computer like I'm using right now, it doesn't last very long in terms of geological time. You know, it's made of metals and plastic. Say if at the same time that some people were using stone tools and weapons 50 million years ago in California, for example, mm-hmm. to stick with that case. If at the same time they were using laptop computers, over 50 million years, the stall isn't going to change that much. If it's not exposed to disturbance. But the laptop computer, the plastics in it are going to dissolve. The metals will oxidize unless there's gold there or a few other rare metals that don't oxidize. It's one reason gold is considered so valuable, doesn't oxidize. So it's so after 50 million years, there may have been a whole industrial civilization just like ours that was present, but you wouldn't be able to detect very much about it. And there were some studies done a few years ago by, there's one researcher, he wrote a book called World Without Us. These are environmental studies, because our industrial civilization has kind of polluted the environment and disturbed it a bit. So sometimes environmentalists wonder, well, what would happen if human beings disappeared from the earth today? What would happen with all our cities, our factories, all our products? What would happen? And they've kind of concluded that over the course of a few thousand years, the automobiles, anything made of metal, would oxidize. The buildings would gradually collapse. Most of them were made of concrete and steel.
They're not meant to last these days.
Huh?
They're not built to last like they were.
Yeah. So, the concrete will rot. The steel beams will eventually corrode. The things will collapse. And fires will burn. The floods, tsunamis. And so that over a few hundred thousand years, it's say practically everything would be gone. So, but on your main point that civilizations go up and down, I believe that definitely is a fact. If you look at some of the descriptions of the ancient civilizations given in the Puranas, the Vedic historical texts, you'll find that they had flying craft. They're called Vimanas. There were cities with palaces and government buildings and residential quarters. And, so there, this, you're right, this isn't the first time that advanced civilization has arisen on Earth.
Have there been any examples in the archaeological digs of what we would call sophisticated technology being preserved in any way?
Well, there are a few things. They're not very old in terms of millions of years. I think there are basically two sources of evidence about what's happened in the past. And one is what we can find in the archaeological record. And what's preserved there isn't a very complete record, because as you were saying, things like what we consider to be high tech stuff doesn't really last very long. But you do have some things like the Antikythera mechanism, which was found in a Greek ship that sunk in the Aegean Sea somewhere. an ancient Greek ship. It had this, it was recovered a long time ago, but the archaeologist who first recovered this object didn't understand what it was. It looked just like a bunch of metal just melted or something. But when they developed technologies for X-ray the interior of this metal, they noticed all kinds of gear wheels all stuck together.
Oh, right. I've seen this one. Yeah. Yeah. All the cogs. Yeah.
Yeah. With engravings of the different planets, planetary signs on them. And they determined, well, this is actually a computer, you know, for calculating the positions of the stars and planets, you know, a very elaborate computing machine. So you do have things like that. And then there are all, now this isn't scientific evidence, but if you go to different temples in India, sometimes they will display things that works of art or objects, sacred objects that are said to be millions of years old, and from different ages, different yugas, they're called in Sanskrit. So you do have that sort of thing. But in my work, I've simply been able to demonstrate that the human species has been around for a long time. I think showing all the ups and downs of civilizations and cultures would take an additional level of research. But whether you have a high civilization or a low civilization, first thing has to be there have to be human beings there. So at least I think I can show that from the archaeological record. Now, the other type of evidence about the past is the knowledge that's come down from those ancient civilizations, from those who have witnessed the past. So you've got your records left by those civilizations. I don't know, and your school of thought, do you have records or that you rely on or Akashic information? Or
let me share my screen. I just got this. This is what we were talking about with the Kali, the yugas, the one Kalpa, because some of these, like, for example, they were saying Atlantis was like 11,000 years ago or something like that. But according to our teachings, it was a lot longer than that because of the length of time. A yuga, this is from my teacher. He said the four yuga periods that equals one Mahayuga or great age is...
At what age does it give for a Mahayuga?
A Mahayuga is 4 million. Okay. 4,320,000.
Yeah, that's similar. That's the traditional understanding which I follow.
Okay.
I know there are some others who have a different yuga system that's shorter. But I would agree with that calculation.
Okay. Yeah, these are big numbers. I mean, I think that's a billion. One Kalpa is 4 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
So, a Kalpa or a day of Brahma, sometimes it's called.
Right. One Kalpa is one day of Brahma, 4.32 billion years. 14 Manvantara is one Kalpa.
Yes. Yes, that is absolutely the timeline that I accept.
Okay. Oh, great. We're on the same page.
Yeah, we're on the same page in terms of time cycles.
So I have this. So we have the Earth. The Earth site on, I think she's on her third incarnation from the sun, according to these teachings. So the Earth has a life cycle of 6 billion years, and we've just reached the halfway point of the Earth's life. We believe that on July 8th, 1964 was the Earth received her primary initiation. So she got energy because the Earth is a living being, and she received this energy from the sun through her heart, but she's keeping it now in abeyance. We believe that we came to this Earth from Maldek, which is now the asteroid belt, because we destroyed Maldek through nuclear weapons. And then we spent about 100,000 years on the lower and higher astral planes, and then about 13 million years in the civilization of Lemuria. And then the Earth, Lemuria, they probed the atom again, and the Earth turned on our axis. And so that's why there's a lot of cold remnants, you know, under the ice, under the North and South Pole, is because she can turn within minutes. And so there'd be like tidal waves 4 miles high and just destroy everything within a matter of minutes. So it's,
yeah. My understanding is that there's a devastation like that at the end of every Manvantara.
They said that she did this deliberately because we're not allowed to destroy another planet. We destroyed Maldek. So there was so we came 18 million years ago, and there was Adamic man here. So maybe some of those records, because Adamic man was much bigger, a much bigger man than us, and much more evolved. And their root chakra was the heart chakra. It's because each chakra is a realm of consciousness. And so we had to spend, according to the teachings, you had to spend 100,000 years on the astral, just because the Earth had to make these different realms so that we could exist on this planet. And so then civilization, Atlantis was destroyed. You know, these are a long time, a lot more than, these are big numbers now. About 800,000 years ago, Atlantis was destroyed. And now we're in the start of Kali Yuga after the death of Lord Sri Krishna.
That's right. We're in the Kali Yuga. I would agree with that. So we have some things in common.
Yeah.
Not everything, but
certainly big numbers.
Do you have any more questions for me?
Oh, of course, yes. Check here. So, because a lot of people, they talk about the missing link now, but there's never been discovered a missing link between Darwin's theory of evolution, between the apes and the
That's what they mean by missing link. It's kind of interesting. Darwin published his book The Origin of Species in 1859. And then he didn't really speak about human evolution in that book, but many scientists started talking about it. Human beings are like other living things. They must have evolved, as Charles Darwin said, from some ancestor. You know, they had some ancestor that was, by natural selection, modified. And, you know, you have this evolutionary progression. They speculated that, that means human beings probably came from some ancestor that is of the ape and monkey family. Not exactly like the apes and monkeys that live today, but from that same group. And so there must be some intermediates between the ancient apes and monkeys and the modern humans. And they called that the missing link. And then they started looking for this missing link, but they weren't finding it. They were finding evidence that humans like us were existing in the distant past. So that went on through the 1860s, the 1870s, the 1880s. It was during this period that you had discoveries like Dr. Whitney's discoveries in California that we were talking about. And then in the 1890s, at the end of the 1890s, there was a discovery in Java at a site called Trinno, where a Dutch researcher named Eugene Dubois found a primitive ape-like skull cap, and about 50 feet away in his excavation, he found a human-like femur or thigh bone, and he put the two together and said, this is the Java ape man, the missing link.
That's convenient.
Pithecanthropus erectus. It's now known as Homo erectus. Yeah, it's considered one of our alleged hominid, they're called, ancestors. But it was found in layers of rock about 800,000 years old. So now they have their missing link. They've been looking for it for decades, but they didn't find it. They were just finding evidence that human beings like us existed millions of years ago. So when this Java man discovery became widely accepted in the world of science at the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, then they had to decide, okay, if we've got our missing link at 800,000 years, that means anything human has to come after that. You know, sometime between the present and 800,000 years ago. And then it became a problem. But what are we going to do with all this evidence that's accumulated between 1859 and 1899? What are we going to do with that? And that's when they started filtering it out of textbooks and scientific presentations. So that evidence has more or less just disappeared. And then after that time, whenever someone would find any evidence that looked human, older than 800,000 years, they would adjust it in some way to make it fit. Yeah. That's still going on today. I'll just give one example and then we can move on. A couple of years ago, in 2016, there was a team of archaeologists working at Olduvai Gorge in the country in East Africa, Tanzania. And they found a finger bone. You know, just it seems like a pretty insignificant thing, but it does have some meaning. So they carefully measured this finger bone, and they compared the measurements to the same finger bone in different species of apes, monkeys, different ape men, like Australopithecus and Homo habilis and so forth. And they also compared it with that of anatomically modern humans. And they found it fit in the human group. It's different than any ape or monkeys, different than any hominids, you know, alleged human ancestors, and fits squarely in the human group. But it was found in layers of rock, 1,800,000 years old. So in their scientific report, the archaeologist said, this finger bone most closely resembles that of modern Homo sapiens. But we can't call it Homo sapiens because of its geological age. In other words, 1,800,000 years. So like I said, after this Java Man discovery, which put their missing link at 800,000 years, if they found anything that looked human after that, they had to interpret it in such a way that it would contradict their paradigm.
Isn't it true that in all the major museums around the world, somebody wrote a book about there are giant skeletons? There are many, many.
I believe there were giants in the past. By giant, I mean somebody 10 feet tall or taller.
Okay.
Because there are a lot of people who are 7 feet tall. They play on basketball.
Yeah, make a good living.
Yeah. And there are a few people on this planet even today who are 8 feet tall. I think there was one man in Mongolia who was 9 feet, but there's nobody 10 feet tall taller. So there are reports, very credible reports, of discoveries of such things. My particular problems, I haven't been able to verify any of them. One of the best reports of evidence that might be verifiable was the discovery by a French anthropologist at a place called Castelmau in southern France, where he discovered very large human bones, not a complete skeleton, but a human femur, humerus, which is the upper arm bone from the shoulder down to the elbow, and several other bones. And if you have a femur or a thigh bone, you measure it, you know, anthropologists can tell you how tall the human being that had that femur had to be. And they calculated that the human being that possessed this thigh bone or femur must have been 11 feet tall or more. And this was published in a scientific journal early in the 20th century with photographs. And if those bones could be found in France today, possibly they're in some museum somewhere, that would be pretty good evidence. As far as the other reports go, there are reports that the Smithsonian had them.
I was going to say the Smithsonian, yeah.
Yeah. And I fully accept that giants existed, but if we try to actually get at least one case where we actually have the physical bones, I think that would help, you know, demonstrate the reality of the phenomena. But up to this time, I haven't been able to see or verify that such bones are still there today. But as I said, I fully accept that in the past there were human beings larger than we are today. It's like you were saying, the pre-Adamite people, bigger. The Vedic literature says that in past ages, people were bigger than they are today. And it's even part of just ordinary science that before 5 or 10,000 years ago, most living things were bigger than they are today. You know, the elephants were bigger, the wolves were bigger, the bears were bigger, the trees were bigger. I live in California. We have the California redwood trees, which are actually the largest living things on Earth, as far as I know. They're huge, 300 feet tall.
And the dinosaurs. Nobody disputes the dinosaurs either, and they were they were pretty big.
Yeah. I think it's today, yes.
Yeah. It's all part of our limitation. Have you also read Madame Blavatsky?
I haven't deeply and intricately studied her work, but I know of it. And I've been invited to speak at theosophical groups in different countries around the world. So I know a little bit about it. I'm not expert in her. I mean, she talks about root races and things like that.
Yeah, she talks about the ionosphere, the ring pass, not about how the prana from the sun and the energies have been gradually limited after Atlantis, after Lemurius, because we needed to go back into, you were talking about a classroom earlier, we're here to learn. And, you know, if you fail, you go back, they send you back a year, and we're going lower and lower, getting smaller and smaller. So,
yeah.
Have you also read the Rig Vedas? The Rig Vedas.
I have.
They also mention the Brahma weapon there and Indra's dart, and that ties in with what Madame Blavatsky said about how they discovered they had nuclear weapons in ancient civilization, just to give you an idea of how advanced they were.
Yeah, they had, well, in the Puranas, it's called a Brahmastra. And the effect of it was, it's described like if you had thousands of suns all concentrated in one place, the energy that comes out of the Brahmastra would be something like that. And it's interesting that Robert Oppenheimer, who was the physicist in charge of developing an atomic bomb for the United States during World War II, in addition to being a great physicist, he was also a student of Sanskrit, and he had read works like the Rig Veda and the Bhagavad Gita, where you find descriptions of these things, like this weapon that explodes with the force of thousands of suns. And at the time the first American atomic bomb was tested in 1945 in Alamogordo, New Mexico, he was present in the bunker. And when the flash of the bomb went off, he began reciting some verses from the Bhagavad Gita where this type of thing is explained. And a newspaper reporter asked him once, what was it like to be present when the first atomic explosion was tested? And he replied, you mean the first atomic explosion in recent times? Yeah, so that's kind of interesting.
Really, mate? I mean, yeah, if these numbers that I showed said were correct, if it would have been on this earth for 18 million years, just say as a thought experiment, like that amount of history, the amount, I mean, there's a real, it's not just a cover up like of a few bones, is it, saying, oh, man's not this, you know, man is actually much older. We were probably, you know, we spend millions of years as animal. We wouldn't, it's a big campaign, no? There's a secrecy and.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of reasons for this knowledge filtering process. One is it's just human nature. If, for example, if I love someone and I hear somebody say something bad about that person, I may become, you know, angry and, you know, won't like to hear it, don't want anybody else to hear it. So many scientists are very much in love with their theories. And if they hear something that contradicts it, they become, you know, defensive, react, you know, negatively. So that's, I think, one aspect of it. And another aspect of it, I think, has to do with power. Yeah, there are different types of power in this world. There's military power, there's economic power, there's political power. There's also intellectual power, which is a very subtle power, but a very real one. And those who possess it, I believe, have the ability to dictate to us our sense of identity. And through their control of the education system, I think the scientific establishment is promoting a certain sense of identity, which is, I am a machine made of molecules in competition with other machines made of molecules, individually and in groups. You know, that competition is there for the control of the material resources and the material production and the wealth that it generates. So, according to that sense of identity, I would tend to believe that my purpose in life basically is to produce and consume more and more material things. And certain groups profit from that. Yeah, they control people on that basis. And if we had another sense of identity, that I'm not just a machine made of molecules, I am a conscious self, a being of pure consciousness. You're a being of pure consciousness. We're all beings of pure consciousness. We can satisfy our material needs in the most simple, natural, efficient, and fair way possible while putting most of our human energy into developing that resource of consciousness. It would be an entirely different kind of civilization, different political arrangements, different financial arrangements, different security arrangements. It would be, you know, we would be saying, well, on the level of consciousness, we're all related. So why divide ourselves up into so many competing groups? And in the process of exploiting material resources in an unsustainable way, destroying the environment and generating conflict at all levels of human society. It's, so this power, the ability to influence people to identify in a certain way, I think is at the root of a lot of the problems the world faces. And there are powerful interests, financial, political, military interests that want to keep things like that. So I think that's one reason for the prominence of material science in the world today. That's their function, to kind of keep us that very limited, particularly understanding of our identity and purpose in this world.
See, yeah, a lot of my work is I'm fighting the materialism, the message of materialism. And you know, if we were talking about reincarnation earlier, and that, you know, consciousness continues after death. And if you think about that, then we have these life between lives. So we die, we reincarnate, we come back here with no memory of our other time around, because it would be very confusing. You know, it's like you're saying, it would, if we had to remember all our past lives, we'd go chasing our exes. We'd try and get our property back. We'd try and right wrongs. So it would be a mess. But I think when we go to the astral plane, according to the teachings of the Ethereal Society, you do retain memory. And the more advanced you are, or the more evolved, or the more involved, because as above, as below. So if you're an involved person, an advanced who's practiced the dark arts, and you go to the astral, you can, time runs at a different speed there, but you can influence the physical plane to your own dark ends. And we are run by the dark forces, who are feeding on the our own bad thoughts and the fear that we generate. So
yeah, that's I do think, yes, we are on this level of reality in contact in different ways with beings, more subtle beings. So higher platforms, and just like, you know, we can observe on this level of reality different categories of personalities, you know, so we would consider to be good and on the path of light. Others are causing pain, suffering to themselves and others, and appear to be, you know, like on the dark side, you might say. So those same kinds of differences are there, the more subtle realms.
Yeah, and they're still learning the lessons they need to learn. I mean, you go, they call it the realm of just desserts. So you go to, if you're a very spiritual person, it's the same in a city, no? If you go to the street or the district that you vibrate at, no, you don't hang out in the ghetto if you're like the culture and the fine arts, you know, it's the same. And so the astral realms are, you know, science is almost there. No, it understands dark matter and dark energy. You know, where is it? You know, they think it's somewhere between the planets, you know, all this energy is, the calculations don't add up, but it's right here in front of us. It's just consciousness, a different frequency, light. It's across the electromagnetic spectrum, matter existing at different vibrations. So, you know, I could be under a mountain on another realm, or under a sea on another realm, but it's still physical, but it's just a different frequency.
Yeah. In some of the Vedic texts, we get the concept of the three modes of material nature. They're called gunas in Sanskrit.
Right.
Three gunas.
Yeah.
Goodness, passion, ignorance.
Sattvic.
Yeah.
To rajasic and tamasic.
Yes, those three. Sattva Rajas Tamas. So sattva is the mode of goodness. A person attracted to the mode of goodness likes to live simply, naturally, is peaceful, is caring, compassionate, wants to help others, and is dedicated to improving the state of consciousness individually and collectively. The rajasic types are more interested in accumulating wealth and opulence and power, and they can, if they're guided by those in the mode of sattva, the sattva guna, they can do tremendous good for people. But if they give in to their selfish inclinations, they have the power to do a lot of damage. And then there are the tamasic types that are just into behaving. They tend to be addicted to intoxicants, acting crazily. A disturbance really to themselves and others. But the modes don't exist in a totally pure state. In the course of the day, one might be influenced in the morning by sattva, during the day a little rajasic impulses come, and then later on you may just think, let me go to sleep.
You need a mix, otherwise you wouldn't, it'd be a terrible day, then.
Yeah.
I had a guest on.
That would be to be, and as far as the bhakti tradition goes, the ultimate would be to get beyond the material modes to the level of pure consciousness, where there's, you're not being influenced by material modes of nature.
Well, here you go. You might find this interesting, because this is the teachings of the Aetherius Society, is that there's spiritual evolution, there's consciousness evolves, and we have to go back to God collectively, basically. You think of the Eastern traditions, you think of the Buddhist tradition, you go, Nirvana is one step away. As you ascend, wham, bam, I'm back to the Almighty. I've ascended now after cosmic consciousness and enlightenment. But we understand from these teachings that consciousness accumulates, amalgamates on its way back to God. So even a galaxy can't go back to God because it hasn't transmuted matter. It's still in matter. So it's a conscious being, but it's in service, but it's not, it can't. Yeah. So, and below that are suns, conscious beings, the Brahma, the Brahma of the Hindu scripts, the God in the Bible is the sun, conscious being, and the earth underneath is a conscious being. And, planets merge to make suns, merge to make greater and greater beings. And so as we evolve, as we raise Kundalini, when we can leave this classroom, I actually spoke to an Ayurvedic doctor on one of my other, on my other podcast, Odd Songs. And I was talking about all the other planets are inhabited as well, just at a different frequency of vibration. And he said, yeah, I know, it's in the Vedas. I was quite surprised, cause all in this coded language. But what we've got with the Aetherius Society is Dr. King was the master for the Aquarian age. So Jesus was the master for the Piscean age. And so Dr. King came here and he channeled these teachings, and we got the book called The Nine Freedoms, and it shows how consciousness amalgamates as you leave this classroom, you go back to God through the planets, you go Saturnian existence, and you merge with another being who you vibrate at. and you merge again later on after solar existence. And so the Earth is a living conscious being, but it's million. Imagine Jesus, the Buddha, Sri Krishna, and all these adepts and masters merged together, millions of years evolved. They can create the consciousness of a level of a planet, of logi of a planet. So that's the kind of this evolving back to God collectively. We don't just go into a cave now, and we have to be among our brothers and sisters, serving collectively each other. And that's kind of the new concept for the Aquarian age.
Yeah, it sounds reminiscent of the teachings of one of the great saintly persons in the Bhakti tradition, Prahlad, who was a boy saint, and he prayed, I don't want to just get liberated myself, go off to the forest and, raise my consciousness. I want to go with everyone, so I go to the cities, the people are, the conscious selves are, and try to go with them. It's just a similar mentality. And it's not,
who's ahead of his time.
Yeah. Sometimes that happens. Everything's there in seed form at the right moment. It sprouts and grows and gives its fruit.
I think there was some allowance in the law made for selfishness in the pursuit of spiritual advancement, that somehow you had to convince people that if they, because obviously when you do raise Kundalini, when you become an adept and a master, you can serve much more, you are much greater use to humanity. So maybe you needed these people to climb the rock face first, send down the ropes, and then they're now working in the, their ascended masters working in the spiritual hierarchy of Earth, behind the scenes to raise us all up. But now, because time is ticking, now we all have to work. Now services, karma yoga is the yoga of the age.
I think you're right, the time is ticking. Because Kali Yuga, it's predicted to be, the age that we're in now, it's predicted in the Vedic literature to be an age of increasing social and environmental disturbance. And it appears to be going on like that, but there's also a prediction that for the next, say, 10,000 years, there's a window of opportunity where there's a chance, an opportunity to make a lot of spiritual progress. Just like when winter's coming, you get some warm days sometimes, like Indian summer, sometimes they call it. Although the trend is down in terms of the temperature, you get some warm days. So according to some of the text, that we're in such a window of opportunity, even though it is Kali Yuga.
That really resonates. Yeah, there is this satellite number 3 is in orbit, magnifying all spiritual actions by 3,000 times, because to Dr. King, he was one that, I'll show you this one as well, I'll show you this screen. So all these masters came back, come from other planets, they incarnate in Earth in a physical body through the womb of a woman to take on karma, and then they can act in the Earth. So they come from, Jesus was from Venus, Saint Peter, Dr. George King, who I mentioned, who founded the Aetherius Society, he was from Mars, and all these masters through the age. That's why there's this linear. That's why there's this red line through all the great world's great religions, is that they were teaching Patanjali there, or Buddha. They're all teaching the same thing, and the cosmic message, basically. So Zoroaster, Sri Krishna started the age, his death marked the start of Kali Yuga. Yes, 3000.
That's the beginning.
And the Lord Babaji, he's been in a physical body for 2 million years on Earth, and he is from Saturn. So all these, you know, people are looking for a life on other planets, and it's all there, but just a different frequency of vibration. And we're in the bottom classroom.
Yeah.
And so,
life is present on all these planets, but we may not be able to detect it, as you say, because our consciousness is not at the right frequency.
So Dr. King, his all these masters, they have a mission, a primary mission, a secondary mission. So the master Jesus, they were doing teaching, and he was doing healing and things like that. And, you know, but his main mission was to die at a particular time to take on karma. Otherwise man would have been set back 17,000 years or something like that. And because of the primary initiation of Earth, that would have held everything back. So, and Dr. King, his primary mission was, besides the teachings, he was terrestrial mental channel, but his main mission was, so he was like basically a Jedi. So he did astral projection into the lower astral realms, and he took on the leaders of the dark forces, in the apocalypse, which happened on the, as predicted, but not on the physical plane. It happened on the lower astral planes. Sorry. And he also took on the alien as well, which was an advanced AI, basically, which could create thought forms, I think up to 40 miles in diameter. So it was a crazy time. Yeah. Beyond science fiction, basically. Because, you know, science fiction only ever goes like 20 years in advance, because people don't have any greater grasp of thinking beyond that. But, I think this has been a fantastic conversation. If you have anything, we could keep chatting all night, but I'm sure you've got other things to do.
People are interested in my work, they can visit my website at cremo.com, cremo.com. There they'll find information about my books, like Forbidden Archaeology, Human Devolution, some others. Actually, my latest book is My Science, My Religion. And if people order that from my website, they will have the option of also receiving, if they want it, a free copy of Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the Vedic texts that has greatly influenced my work. And they would also find an interview link that would be announcing my appearances, media appearances like this podcast. And they'd also find upcoming in-person events, like next week, April 1st through the 4th, I'm going to be at Mount Shasta and the conference there, the Conscious Living Summit. And it's I'll be speaking at that event. So good to have been with you today.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. So I'm on your website now. So you have other websites as well, Human Devolution, MySscienceMyReligion.com.
Yeah, those are for the individual books. Yeah,
individual books.
Okay. Mount Shasta is a spiritual retreat for the spiritual hierarchy of Earth. That's a very sacred mountain, yeah?
I've heard that, yes.
The saint
there?
No, not that I know of. Saint Gu Ling, he who visualized the Ethereal Society into being, he did it inside Mount Shasta. He's based inside there. He's the keeper of the seal for the Great White Brotherhood.
What is the name again?
Saint Gu Ling. He is the master, and right. And it's the Great White Brotherhood or spiritual hierarchy of Earth. Great White Brotherhood, because they're mostly Indians and mixture of men and women, but it's white magic. That's why it's got that name.
Okay.
But it's a spiritual hierarchy of Earth. So yeah, deep inside the mountain. I don't think they'll.
Do they have a community up there?
It's the spiritual hierarchy of Earth. So you won't see them unless they want to be seen. They're ascended masters. So they're like people who spoke to Madame Blavatsky and I understand
and appreciate that.
Yeah. I would love to meet one of them. If you do meet any of them, let me know.
Okay.
I'd love to have one on the show, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think I'd be way above my pay grade. Yeah.
Maybe they'll be feeling a little compassion.
I wouldn't know what would you say if you met an ascended master? I mean, what would you ask them? I mean, they can read your mind. In that case,
I would say, you're in my heart and you know everything. Tell me what I need to know.
Tell me what to do. Yeah.
What I need to know.
Yeah. Got it. That looks beautiful. Yeah, I'm sure you have a lovely time in spring in Mount Shasta. The energy there will be off the scale.
I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thanks again, Michael. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, Jack.
You have a great day.
You too, and all your viewers and listeners.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Namaste.
Namaste.